Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to check out the new episode of Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a guy who is running out of new things to dangle off of.
Mike Tricchio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I am doing just great. It's my long and storied career of hanging off stuff. Bit of a rough spot right now. But
yeah, I mean, because you have climbed on so many things. You have gone rock climbing. You have dangled off the side of the Burj Khalifa. You have dangled off of an airplane, a helicopter. What is left?
You know, it's just I'll figure it out. I don't think there's anything left, really.
You think you're done? That's it?
Yeah. I'm going to go out on top.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Also joining us is a guy who we've mentioned on the show a couple of times. You'll recognize his voice as the guy who sings our theme songs for film news and discussions. Kyle Cullen, welcome to Film Bookcast.
I'm so glad you're finally having me on, Mike and Mike.
Yes, this has been a long time coming, I think, and you've been requesting to be on the show for a while, pretty much ever since we started bringing guests on the show.
Pretty much, yeah. Since I brought you your first guest.
I wouldn't say you brought me my first guest. I think he approached
me. I introduced the two of you.
Okay, that's true, but it's not like you were saying, you know, you should have Vin on the show. Vin is a longtime friend, and he is a great guest, and he's probably going to be better than you are. But let's...
You know what? You're probably right.
Kyle was really saying, not we should have Vin on, but we should have him on. And right. You just ignored that part.
I might have. But we wanted to have you on for this episode, Kyle, because you are a huge fan of the Mission Impossible movies.
That is 100% true.
Yes, and I believe I was the one who made you be a huge fan of Mission Impossible movies. That's on me. As I feel like I do with a lot of things in your life.
That is true.
Yeah.
can't
first
deny.
First Fast and the Furious, then Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I've turned you into an action movie aficionado. Before you were an action movie...
Amateur.
Amateur is the word.
There you go.
Thank you, Mike. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are talking about the latest film from director Chris McQuarrie and the sixth film in the Mission Impossible series, Mission Impossible Fallout. We've been looking forward to this one for a really, really long time. Mike, I know you rewatched all the other Mission Impossibles before you got to see this. You talked about it on the podcast a couple weeks ago, right?
Yes. Yeah. Did a whole rewatch.
Yes. I did the same. I rewatched all five of them before I got to go see Fallout, which I think was turned out to be very much worth it, because I think this one does call back to all five movies in really interesting ways. And we'll talk about that when we get to actually talk about the movie. Before we move on to the film news, I did want to bring something up. Some kind of crazy non-film news that we're going to talk about. Personal news. Actual human news that we're going to talk about today. Film Bookcast is going to go on hiatus for a couple of months, which is, you know, a bit of a bummer, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, but the reason is I'm actually moving away. I'm going to Montana. I'm going to be a Montanian. And
that's not a real thing, is it? That can't be.
It's going to be once I move to Montana.
Oh, all right.
You and the six other people that live in Montana.
Yeah, well, they'll overlap with the six people who listen to this podcast. So,
that's true.
That'll be great.
How about that?
Anyway, yeah, so I'm moving to Montana. I got a new job out there. I'm very excited about it. But because of that, I have a lot of like moving things to do and such like that. I got to drive out to Montana, and I got to settle in for a few weeks. So we're going to put Film Bookcast and The Complete Works on hiatus for a little while. I think we're going to come back in the middle of September. That's kind of my goal, because I think... At that point, I will have assimilated to Montanian life. I will own a cowboy hat. And then we will probably review The Predator. I think The Predator will be the one to come back on, because that's coming out in the middle of September. So that would be a good one to come back on. So just wanted to announce that to all the Film Bookcast fans out there that you will be a short one podcast, or two podcasts, I guess, if you also listen to Complete Works, for a couple months. And that's a bummer. But you can catch up on other podcasts in the meantime. Go listen to... I don't know. What podcast do you guys listen to?
Kyle, do you want to plug anything?
I'll plug...
Are you starting your own podcast while we're away? The Book Film Cast?
You know, I might have to, because two of the podcasts I listen to are Film Book Cast and The Complete Works. So I don't know what I'm going to do in the meantime.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. I mean, I know you're a big fan of How Did This Get Made? So if you want to listen to How Did This Get Made, that's a good one.
Great podcast.
Yeah, great podcast. We're going to plug podcasts that have much bigger fan bases than ours. That's what we'll do. You guys heard of this Comedy Bang Bang thing? It's pretty great.
Check out...
Harmontown, that's a good one.
Is Vin's podcast out yet? Is that a thing?
Bar Fight? No, it's not out yet. I did record an episode of that podcast a while back because he had a Nicolas Cage-themed episode. And so naturally, I was the perfect guest for it. He wanted to have you on too, Mike. I think I told you about this.
Yeah.
But he wanted to do it in person, so there, we couldn't do it really via Skype, and you're all the way in Long Island. So we did record an episode probably like a month ago at this point, but he says he had some difficulty editing it. So hopefully it should be out by the fall is what he's saying now.
You know, Vin invited me to be on that podcast. I didn't have to beg.
Let's just go to film news.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's hear Kyle's song. It's film news. All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we got a lot of things to get through, because it has been a few weeks since our last episode. Our last episode was Ant-Man and the Wasp, which was at the beginning of July, and we're recording this on the last day of July, so we got a lot of stuff to get through. So I cut out a lot of stories. I just wanted to talk about the really big ones, and I think the biggest film news that happened this past month has got to be the stuff surrounding James Gunn and Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Obviously, I'm sure both of you guys know, James Gunn was fired by Disney from Guardians of the Galaxy 3 over some controversial tweets that he tweeted about a decade ago, which was kind of brought up again due to a campaign by Mike Cernovich, a far-right blogger. He's a guy who was in started the Pizzagate conspiracy theory and all that stuff. So obviously, this is pretty insane news. Nobody saw this coming. Mike, what was your take on the James Gunn news?
My initial reaction, well, I saw the tweets, I read some of them, and I was like, yeah, you like, all right, you fucked up, dude, see you later. but then I read a little bit more and saw that it was in response to Gunn going after some far-right people on Twitter, and then this Pizzagate guy was like, oh, yeah, well, look at these things from 10 years ago. Now, that said, like, some of those tweets, not great.
They're definitely in bad taste, and they're not. But they're also make sense for the kind of filmmaker and guy James Gunn was at the time, right?
Yeah, and especially like how seemingly small the internet was in 2008, right? There was still in Twitter, especially was, you know, like Ellen DeGeneres and Ashton Kutcher were the big celebrities, and you know. But some of the stuff, like the things he was saying, sort of make sense for 2008 internet. It's very weird. It's hard to explain and like make sense of now.
Sure. But at the time, you know, the dark edgelord kind of thing, there was like a fan base for that kind of humor.
Yeah, and like it was popular on the internet. Like Hitler and rape jokes were not uncommon in 2008.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Not that that was a thing that's okay, but, you know. But and then, you know, I sort of sat with it and thought about it and seeing how much Gunn has changed and has denounced that stuff that he used to do and has like grown as a person, it seems, that I think that's something society should reward, right? Like learning from your mistakes and becoming a better person for having gone through that and you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, he apologized for these tweets recently, but he also apologized for these tweets back in 2012. Like before he was even hired for Guardians of the Galaxy. I think he was probably in the process of being hired for it. So these tweets were a matter of public knowledge. Disney knew about them before they hired him. And so it came as a shock. I was off Twitter for that week when it happened. And Kyle, you were actually the one who broke this news to me.
Yeah. I saw it online. I'm like, why isn't Mike telling me about this? This is where I get my news from you two.
Yeah, exactly. I was off Twitter that week because I was engaging in what I called hashtag concertpalooza. I went to a different concert every night. It was awesome. Mike, you were there for some of them.
I went to two. It happened.
Yeah. But anyway, so I really didn't have time to keep up with news and stuff on Twitter. It was kind of nice. It was actually really amazing to not be on Twitter for that week. But anyway, so the James Gunn news broke on that Friday, and I was shocked about it. So I really hadn't been following it. Looking back on that week, like James Gunn had been talking about it, and he was like issued an apology and talked about the tweets and stuff like that. And he left them up, you know, to his credit. He didn't like delete them, you know, to try to hide them or anything. He left them up to preserve, like, you know, show like his transparency and show how much he's grown as a person in that time. And yeah, I feel like Disney really made a huge mistake here because like, the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise is so intertwined with who James Gunn is. Like, I can't picture what a Guardians of the Galaxy movie looks like without James Gunn, to the point where they even brought him in on Infinity War, right? He rewrote a lot of the Guardians dialogue in that movie. But he has changed a lot as a person. He's not making those jokes anymore. And also, they were jokes. He's not actually a pedophile. And I feel like...
We hope.
Well, Okay, but they were like, there's no evidence to suggest that James Gunn is a pedophile. But people are shouting at it because he made those tweets. Like, if you read the replies on anything about James Gunn, it is the worst stuff of all. So yeah, it's a bummer. And the Guardians cast, to their credit, has stood behind James Gunn. They actually, I think today or yesterday, they posted an open letter, kind of asking Disney to rehire James Gunn in that regard. Like, they're standing behind him, and, you know, he's grown as a person, all that thing. So I guess we'll see how this goes. I don't see a situation where Disney changes their mind. But it is a bummer. It's a weird situation.
Yeah. It also has that weird corporate hypocrisy thing, right? Where it was like, we don't support statements of this kind, which is funny because it's Disney who made one of the most racist movies ever in Song of the South. Okay. Songs of the South.
That was like 60 years ago, and they have tried to bury that one, to be fair.
Well, yeah, but like, this shit was 10 years ago, and James Gunn apologized.
Yes,
you
definitely.
Know? It's the same thing. Yeah,
yeah, and right. I mean, and people have tried to compare it to the Roseanne Barr thing from a few weeks back, but that's a whole different thing, because those were current tweets that she was throwing out there.
Like, that was stuff she said last week. What are you talking about?
So yeah, it's very weird, and hopefully it gets resolved. Like, I'm hoping to see James Gunn reinstated as the Guardians of the Galaxy director, at least to finish out the trilogy, you know?
Yeah.
Because I doubt he'll take on... I think he was going to do Guardians 3 and then kind of act as a consultant for the big cosmic side of the Marvel Universe after that. And I doubt that's going to happen if he comes back for Guardians 3 at this point. But I would like to see Disney kind of change their mind. Like, he turned over a new leaf, and he's... like, even if you just followed him on Twitter... I followed him on Twitter for a very long time, since, like... probably 2012 or something, and you can just see like his progression as a person throughout that time. So anyway, yeah, so that's kind of the biggest news that's come out, and it kind of buried the other Marvel news that came out, which is that Marvel is working on a Black Widow movie, which I'm curious if you guys do you feel like a Black Widow movie is what you want at this point? I feel like the time for this may have passed, and what they're talking about doing, it would be like a prequel set, like it's like about Black Widow's origins, and to me that's less interesting than doing like a new Black Widow adventure. But they did hire a director for the movie, Kate Shortland, who I guess Scarlett Johansson is a big fan of. She directed a movie called Lore a few years ago, which got a lot of critical acclaim. So yeah, I mean, are you guys into the idea of a Black Widow movie?
I'm down for a Black Widow movie if it's Black Widow, Okoye, and Scarlet Witch.
Okay, yes, like, that would be dope.
30-second movie we got in the middle of Infinity War, fuego.
Yes, that would be pretty dope. Kyle, what about you? Are you a Black Widow fan? Do you want a Black Widow movie?
I mean, I'm a fan of the character of Black Widow. Like you were saying, I'm not quite sure if the time has passed for a Black Widow movie, considering she's been in however many 20 Marvel movies there's been.
She's been in, I think, six of them. Like,
she's been in a lot of them. But I'm not against a standalone movie. I'm less for an origin story. Since we kind of, sort of know enough about her origin story, and I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm like 50-50 right now.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. And yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I'd be into an origin story, I guess, but it also feels, it's weird that the female superheroes that are getting movies keep making movies set in the past, right? Because Wonder Woman was in the World War I, and Wonder Woman 2 is in 1984. Captain Marvel's going to be set in the 90s. So it's just a little odd.
I just think, I mean, yeah, it's weird that it's like, it's so much of an afterthought that it literally has to take place in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely weird, but, like, that's it. I mean, just like a Scarlett Johansson action movie, like, I'm down. Like, she's a talented, action star. I mean, I really liked Lucy, when that movie came out, and I, like... Like, you know, she can hold her own in an action movie. I think
that's the first time that sentence has ever been uttered.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, Lucy, not bad. But, I mean, Scarlett Johansson's made some odd choices lately. I mean, I'm sure you've seen some of that. But, you know, I think she is a capable action star, and she's a really talented actress. So a Black Widow solo movie, like, I'm down. But I would rather see it take place after, you know, all the Infinity War stuff. And if it is, like, Okoye and Scarlet Witch and Black Widow, like, that would be awesome. Like, make it, like, a backdoor female Avengers movie. Like, I'm down. That'd be great.
That would be amazing.
I'm on board for that movie.
Yeah, definitely. So, we'll see.
I was going to say, the other option I would be super down for is if it's an origin story, but also, like, Mission Impossible 1 ripoff. Just, like, a hard Brian De Palma espionage thriller.
Right. Yeah, that's what I figure a Black Widow movie would have to be, like, kind of a spy thriller, like, kind of in the vein of Winter Soldier, I think, would be the closest comparison. But yeah, we'll see how that happens, if it happens, when it happens, because I think the Marvel schedule, if James Gunn does not get rehired for Guardians 3, I think the scheduling for a lot of the movies is going to flip around, you know, because Guardians 3, I think, was supposed to come out in 2020, Which would mean Disney would have to hire a new director very soon if that's going to be the case. So we'll see if Black Widow maybe gets pushed up or whatever. We'll see what happens. But anyway, let's move on from Marvel news. I do have some Star Wars news I wanted to mention pretty briefly, which is that the full Star Wars cast has been announced. I think it was last week we talked about Billy Dee Williams. Now he's back in Star Wars Episode 9. And most of the cast of the Star Wars movies, like the new trilogy of Star Wars, is back. Kerry Russell is in this movie now, which is pretty cool. Got that J.J. Abrams connection going on. And the bigger news that just came out is that Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher will appear in Star Wars Episode 9. Now, Mark Hamill, I assumed, will be in 9, right? I think we all kind of thought, like, well, there's no way, like, you know, there's Force Ghosts in Star Wars. Like, there's no...
Yeah.
like they exist. Luke's not going to not be in Star Wars. The Carrie Fisher news is a little more surprising, obviously, because Carrie Fisher passed away 2 years ago at this point. And, you know, Disney has said they're not going to CGI her performance or anything like that. I think we all assumed that she would get written out somehow. But now they're saying they have unused footage of Carrie Fisher from Force Awakens, I think, that they're going to integrate into this movie. And on the one hand, I think that's kind of cool. It's a nice way to pay tribute to Carrie Fisher. On the other hand, I'm not sure how organically that's going to fit into the story. So I'm curious where you guys stand on this. Kyle, you are the biggest Star Wars fan that I know. You have a tattoo of a Death Star on the back of your leg. So what's your stance? What's your stance on this news surrounding Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill?
I obviously was very sad when Carrie Fisher passed away. And I was immediately curious as to what they were going to do with Episode 8. And how they were going to, if they were going to write her out during that movie.
Right.
And like the scene where the ship blows up and I'm like, is that it? Is that where they're ending this? And then she came back and she threw the end of the movie. And after the movie was over, I kept pondering, like, I don't know how comfortable I am with them writing her out. Like in the interim, like before the next movie, they just come back like, oh yeah, Princess Leia's gone.
Kermit?
So...
it's all Muppets now.
The Muppet Star Wars movie? Yeah. I mean, I'd watch that.
That's kind of what Return of the Jedi is.
You're not wrong. But I'm not against them using unused footage of her to finish out her story as long as it works. And as long as it doesn't feel like forced in just for the sake of, we have this footage, let's use it.
Yeah.
As long as it makes sense, I'm okay with it.
Okay, yeah. My fear is that it's going to be like the Jeff Goldblum scenes in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
Mike, I know. Just two minutes of...
Yeah, just like kind of just thrown in there, like, hey, we got Jeff Goldblum for this, let's have him make a speech and get out, kind of thing. Mike, what's your take?
Yeah, I think I agree with Kyle that, in principle, I'm okay with it. It feels a little weird. It feels less weird than CGI Peter Cushing, but...
Yeah, definitely.
I'm okay with it as long as it isn't obviously, like... You know, that's not where we were just standing. Like, if it's, like, clearly the set from Force Awakens or something really weird. Not that that's going to happen, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Where it doesn't feel super forced.
I'm picturing a Poochie situation from The Simpsons where it's, like, you see, like, her mouth move. It's like, I have to go now. My planet needs me. And then she floats away.
Yeah, exactly.
Which there's precedent for her floating now. But
There is.
It's possible.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I expected Episode 9 to open on Princess Leia's funeral. Like, I thought that's what the route was going to be. But I'm okay with them using it as long as it works and organically ends Leia's story and doesn't just, like, have her show up but we don't get a conclusion or anything weird like that. We'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, we'll definitely see what happens. I mean, I think it's an Abrams production again, so I think there's going to be a lot of mystery box elements and we won't know what's going on until we're seeing the movie. We'll see what happens there. But let's move on from the Star Wars news. Got to talk about another big sci-fi franchise from the 80s. Didn't really have the... I mean, the first movie was huge. The rest of the movies didn't really have the cultural impact that Star Wars did. But RoboCop, make it a comeback, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Again?
Well, Detroit has a cancer. Cancer is crime.
Let the woman go. You are under arrest.
You better back up, pal!
Your move, creep.
So there was a RoboCop remake a couple years ago, which I believe I think we talked about it on the podcast.
Did you? Was it a discussion for you? Because I never saw it.
I think it was discussion for me. I mean, I don't know when we might have talked about it. It came out in 2014, the beginning of 2014. So it was before our podcast had actually started, but I feel like I talked about it in an early episode of the podcast anyway. And I'm pretty sure I called it RoboCop the Remake, and we just started calling it that from now on. Like, that's the official title of the movie.
Yeah.
But the, honestly, the remake's not bad. But anyway,
it's not.
There was a new RoboCop movie in town. It's called RoboCop Returns, and it's being directed by Neil Blomkamp.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that guy, he's coming back, I guess. He's in director jail for a couple of years, I feel like, you know, with a couple of duds on his hands, like Elysium and Chappie. But yeah, and he was supposed to make an Alien movie. Remember this? He was supposed to make, like, an Alien movie that ignored the other Alien sequels past Aliens. And now he's making a RoboCop movie that ignores the RoboCop sequels. So it's...
He's got an MO, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so I don't know, man. I'm not sure if I would buy that for a dollar. hashtag RoboCop reference.
Son of a bitch. I am... man, I don't know how to feel about Neil Blomkamp. Like, I'm always rooting for that dude.
Yeah.
And just, like, keeps letting me down.
Okay, yeah. I mean, he made those three movies, District 9, Elysium, and Chappie, and they kind of got progressively worse. I kind of like Chappie more than Elysium, but we'll table that for now. But so he hasn't really made anything in a couple of years, but he has made a couple of short films that have gone online recently, and I haven't really watched them, but I've heard they're pretty good.
It's so, a YouTube channel. Oh, sorry. A YouTube channel. I think it's called Oats Studios.
Yeah.
And I've watched one of them, and it's fucking intense. Like, it's just, like, it's almost like Predator. Like, it's this weird jungle, horror, super heavy practical effects gore stuff. Like, it's pretty cool. So, like, I was hoping that was going to be, like, I mean, maybe that'll allow him to return to making cool stuff.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I think the key here will be if he's directing and not writing, it'll probably be pretty good. That's my hope. Kyle, are you a RoboCop fan?
I never saw the originals. I did see RoboCop the Remake.
Okay.
And I thought it was fine.
It's a totally fine movie that I have not thought about since I saw it. Until right now.
I'm pretty much in the exact same boat. I watched it, and while I was watching it, I thought to myself, this is definitely a movie. And I didn't think any more, and I didn't think any less. It was just right down the middle.
Yeah. I think that's definitely the attitude that you want to have for a movie, is that it is definitely a movie. Are you a fan of Neil Blomkamp, though? District 9, Elysium, Chappie, have you seen any of those movies?
I have not. I've heard you talk about them from time to time.
Cool.
I've heard Chappie referenced occasionally. So that is my knowledge of Neil Blomkamp. So I don't know how I feel.
Okay.
Considering how you guys talk about Chappie.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we reviewed Chappie. That was one of our first reviews. Yeah. We kind of liked it when we saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were kind of fans of Chappie. I feel like since then, I haven't seen it since in theaters. And the flaws kind of became more apparent over time as people kept pointing them out. But but anyway, yeah. So I don't know. I'm kind of rooting for Neil Blomkamp. I'm rooting for new RoboCop. We'll see how this goes. But we do have to move on. Here's some other news. And I wanted to bring this up because it might be like the following sentence that I say may be like the most repellent sentence I've ever said in my entire life.
Oh boy.
Tom Hooper, director of films like The King's Speech, Les Miserables, and The Danish Girl, is making an adaptation of the musical Cats, starring Taylor Swift, Jennifer Hudson, James Corden, and Ian McKellen. And the combination of Tom Hooper, Cats, and James Corden is one of the most toxic combinations to me. Like, I'm getting hives just talking about it. It's bad.
Jesus.
I don't know. Are any of you fans of Tom Hooper, Cats, James Corden, Taylor Swift?
Well... To answer all of your questions with one concise word, no.
Yeah, fair. I mean, I think, Tom Hooper obviously directed Les Mis, so he has the musical experience. But I was not a fan of Les Mis. I think that movie is pretty bad. I'll be curious if he does the live singing thing again, like he did in Les Mis.
Oh, God, I hope not.
or if he does, I
hard zoom on everyone's face.
Hard zoom on everyone's face. Everybody's on a 90-degree angle. hopefully he brings Russell Crowe back. That's my only
I'm all about that,
because honestly, like, people gave Russell Crowe a lot of shit when Les Mis came out. He and Sacha Baron Cohen are the two elements of that movie that I like.
I forgot Sacha Baron Cohen was in that movie.
Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen sings Smash with the House. It's delightful. And Russell Crowe, I don't know, Russell Crowe's weird singing voice to me is the only compelling thing about that movie. And it was the thing people disparaged the most, and I was like, how could you not be on board with the dulcet tones of Russell Crowe.
5 years for what you did. Arrest because you tried to run. Yes, 24601.
My name is Jean Valjean.
And I'm Javert. Do not forget my name.
Russell Crowe's melodic talking voice.
Yes, you will not go for David, Jean Valjean, John. Prisoner 24601.
What if he just does that song, but in cats?
In full cat makeup.
Yeah.
He's in cat makeup, but he's in the French military outfit. Just surrounded by cats.
Yeah. Are you trying to get me on board for this movie? Because it's working.
Well, yeah, what if there's nobody in cat costumes and it's just CGI cats?
Oh, Christ.
It's like the Jungle Book.
It's the Jungle Book.
That's just like hell. That is my hell.
Man.
Just giant CGI cats.
Yeah, I mean, cats, I don't know. Are you guys familiar with the musical Cats at all? Like, have you listened to any of the songs in Cats or anything like that?
Not particularly. I mean, culturally, but not.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've probably heard some of the songs in, like, a Broadway CD or whatever this is, but I've never gone out of my way to listen to songs from Cats.
The big one is Memory. Memory is the big song from Cats. It's like, Memory, All Alone in the Moonlight. Yeah.
I had no idea that was from Cats.
That's from Cats. But Cats is terrible. Cats is a terrible play. I think it's, like, easily Andrew Lloyd Webber's worst. Like, I mean, I haven't heard everything he's ever done, but, like, it's easily the worst thing he's ever done.
You feel confident in saying that.
And I feel like the only redeeming quality about Cats the musical is the live element of it, and making a movie inherently takes that away from it. So, yeah, we'll see what happens with this. I doubt I'll see this movie, because I'm not a fan of Tom Hooper, I'm not a fan of Cats, and I'm not a fan of James Corden.
I saw a great tweet going around that was, you know, typically movie versions of musicals end up taking a great musical and making a shit movie. And it's a bold strategy to start with a shit movie or shit play and make a movie with it.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah. It could be the reverse, and it could be the fucking greatest movie we've ever seen.
Could be. Yeah. Never know. Like, this could be.
Probably not, but yeah, you never know.
It could be the Mad Max Fury Road of Cats.
Of musicals.
Of musicals.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so let's move on from that. I got one last bit of news. This is actually TV news, but I'm pretty excited about it. Because I've been a fan of Joss Whedon for a very long time. You know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a huge show for me. Angel, I love. Huge fan of Firefly. Big fan of that show. I even like Dollhouse. Dollhouse is a pretty good show. And it's been a while since he's made anything. I think he directed Avengers Age of Ultron back in 2015. And he's been pretty much laying low since then. He hasn't really, like, he's talked about some projects here and there, but nothing's ever came together. And now he's leaving the film world behind for now, and he's returning to TV with a new HBO show called The Nevers, which has the most Joss Whedon premise of all time. It's about three Victorian women who get superpowers and get on a mission and stuff like that. It's very Joss Whedon-y. I'm pretty excited about it, because I've always wondered what he can do on, like, a basic cable kind of budget and, you know, without the constraints of network television. But on top of that, a new show is being developed set in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer universe, which will be show run by Monica Ubusu-Breen, who works on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I was a little trepidatious about this at first, because it was reported as this would be like a reboot of Buffy. Like, it was going to be like a new character, like it would be a new actress playing Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all the cast and all that.
That's what I heard floating around.
Yeah, that was the original, like, that's what it was reported as. And I was not on board with that, because I was like, you know, the idea of Buffy the Vampire, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer sets it up so well where you could continue the series in some other way. Because the finale of Buffy, Kyle, I know you haven't watched it, but Mike, you watched Buffy, right?
I did, yeah.
Okay, yeah. The finale of Buffy ends with, spoilers for a 15-year-old TV show, I guess. but the finale of Buffy ends with all the potential Slayers in the world realizing their power. So theoretically, you could just follow any of those Slayers and make a TV show out of it. And it sounds like that's actually what they're going to be doing. Because originally it was reported that it was going to be a reboot, and everybody was like, no, let's not do that. Let's not do that. So yeah, now it's going to be like a new show. I think it's set in a black female lead and get it with a whole new cast and new characters and stuff like that. And I like this a lot better because it's more like the Lego sequel thing. You can build on the mythology of Buffy and Angel without having to rely on the old cast members or rely on like what our memories are of the previous show. You can just do a whole new thing, and maybe every once in a while, like, you can have a cameo from Sarah Michelle Gellar, like, thrown in there. Like, that would be cool. So, Mike, you were a fan of Buffy. What's your take on this?
I am much more down for a, what'd you call it, Lego sequel?
A legacy sequel, yes.
Yes. For that, I am so not interested in another reboot of a thing that I enjoy a lot of.
Right.
not in like, oh, they're going to ruin it. Just like, I want new shit. Stop giving me the same stuff over and over again.
Right.
But this kind of, you know, toes the line between both of those things, I guess, if it's going to be set in the same universe but follow a new cast, a new story and stuff. So, yeah, I'm interested in it for now.
Yeah, I'm down. And I think Monica Oostabreen, like, she has worked with Joss Whedon. She is like one of the key writers and agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So I think she can nail the Whedon-esque dialogue that she needs to nail for this kind of project. So I'm down. And Kyle, you've never watched Buffy, so I'm assuming you have no opinion on this.
Not really, no.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Tell my wife I said hello.
Hello. Yeah, I know how popular Buffy is amongst people like you, and I've got a lot of friends who are big fans of it, and like you said, it was originally reported as a reboot, and all of my friends were like, fuck that, don't let that happen. But hearing that it's going to be set in the same universe, I think that's a lot better. Yeah. And yeah, maybe I'll give it a shot. Okay. Who knows?
I think you should watch Buffy when you get a chance. It's real good.
I probably should.
Yeah, it's only 144 episodes. You can knock that out in a week, right?
Roughly, yeah.
Anyway, so I think that about wraps up our film news, guys. Let's move on into Kyle's other theme song, Discussions, starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. So, Kyle, let's start with you. You got something to discuss?
I do. Recently, I watched F is for Family on Netflix.
I don't like to drink and drive, but when I have to, I drink White House beer.
White House beer, the one draft you won't want to dodge.
I was watching that.
No, you weren't. And now you're not.
Can you hold down the fort while I'm gone?
You're just going to leave me alone with these animals?
You leave them with me.
But that's our deal.
You know what you were getting into when you let me get into you?
Gross!
Okay.
It's two seasons. It's an animated adult cartoon, I would say, starring Bill Burr, Laura Dern, Justin Long, among others. And set in the 1970s, it's a, I guess you'd call them lower middle class family, working father, wife stays at home, takes care of their three terrible, terrible, terrible kids. And it's just a fun time. It's two seasons. Each episode's 22 to 24 minutes long. So it's a quick watch. Each season's only, like, I think, less than 10 episodes. And god damn, it's funny.
Yeah.
It is just so fucking funny. It's not like a super over-the-top cartoon where they're getting into all sorts of shenanigans. It's all, like, pretty... Like, oh, yeah, that could probably happen. I could see that actually happening.
Okay. It's more like a King of the Hill type show.
Kind of, yeah. It's in the same vein, just a lot more vulgar.
Okay.
Bill Burr is just, this is the role he was born to play, as my friend always says.
As an angry father? That's the...
An angry father, just constantly yelling.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right.
It's truly, truly amazing, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Okay, yeah, that's F is for Family. That's a Netflix original. And, yeah, I remember I wanted to check that out around the time it came out, because I do like Bill Burr, and I love Laura Dern, so that's cool, too. And I enjoy, you know, animated comedies and things thereof. But, yeah, I've not checked out F is for Family. Mike, have you seen it?
No, I've heard of it, though. Is it one of those things that's, like, partly based on his stand-up also, or, like, his life, or one of those
kind
of...
Yeah, I think... I believe it is.
Not as far as I can... Well, it might be. Not as far as I can tell. His character plays a man who was in the military, and him and his wife had a child, like, when he just got out of the military, and they started a family instead of him starting his career. And he works at kind of a dead-end job at an airport, and I don't know how much of it's based on his real experiences, but it feels like it's a story that has happened to a family in the 70s.
Okay, cool beans.
Fair enough.
All right, so that's F is for Family, available on Netflix. Mike, you got a couple things to talk about?
Yes. The first thing I have to talk about is a movie called Don't Kill It.
You have had three triple homicides in the past week, is that correct? He killed him, and then he killed his own kid? Make any sense. They are unrelated, right?
Well, they might be the tiniest bit related.
In what way would that be, Chief?
Each one killed the last. Your town is in real danger. You want these murders to stop, you best listen. I'm a hunter. Demon hunter.
You said this one is unique. How?
So the way it transfigured was by being killed. The moment you killed the thing, it became you.
And what are you going to do when you find him?
Oh, I'll sit him down for a quiet little chat.
Came out in 2017, directed by Mike Mendez, and stars Dolph Lundgren. And this is a horror comedy. It's available on Netflix. It's a horror comedy in which Dolph Lundgren plays a demon hunter who tracks a demon to the small rural town in Texas and has to kill the demon. And it's fucking hilarious and goofy and campy. And it's Dolph Lundgren doing, like, a Texan accent as a demon hunter. God. It's an hour and a half long. Go watch it. It's on Netflix.
Hold up. You're telling me that Dolph Lundgren played a demon hunter in a horror comedy that came out last year and I didn't know about it?
Correct. Breaking news.
What?
This is literally the movie Mike would force me to watch.
me too, honestly. Yes. It's this demon that possesses people, and the way it, like, spreads is through being killed. So, like, as it causes more terror, it, you know, it goes between people, and it's just, like, gory and goofy, and it's Dolph Lundgren as a demon hunter. What more do I need to say?
No more. I'm on board. Yeah. You sold it to me. Bought it.
That just shot to the top of my list. What is it called again?
It's called Don't Kill It.
Don't Kill It. Does he kill it?
I mean, I can't, so I won't spoil it.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's in the title, Mike.
Yeah, you have to find out.
Okay, and you got one more?
Yes. The second movie is a movie that I'm, like, ashamed that it took me this long to see, and that is Kubo and the Two Strings.
You're growing stronger. You might not want to look quite so pleased about that. We grow stronger. The world grows more dangerous. Life has a funny way of keeping things balanced.
Monkey, do you ever say anything encouraging?
I encourage you not to die.
Yes!
2016, directed by Travis Knight. Starring Charlize Theron, Matthew McConaughey. I don't know who's the kid. Who's Kubo?
It's Art Parkinson from Game of Thrones, the kid who plays Rickon.
Oh, my God. What? Yeah. That's amazing. and this is from friend of the show, Leica Studios.
I plug them very often.
All the time. And it's a Japanese folktale, I believe. Kind of retelling. Amazing stuff.
Definitely
motion.
In that style, yeah.
Yeah. Like all of Leica's movies. Does this win the Academy Award for Best Animated? Or is nominated,
I believe it was nominated. What came out that year? That was 2016.
It's probably like Cars 5 or some shit.
Yeah, for some reason, I don't think it won. Because I feel like the Academy is kind of...
It's like Leica. They never get... recognized.
Right. I mean, they occasionally, I think Coraline was nominated when that came out, but I feel like Kubo was probably nominated, but I don't think it won. I'll look that up while you're talking.
But I was going to say, I don't need to say a whole lot because it's Kubo. I feel like it was a pretty big movie amongst our crowd, you know.
Right.
The film nerd. So good. I'm pretty sure I actually saw it with you, Mike.
You did? Yeah.
It was me, you, and Sam, and it was just mind blowing the whole time. Just in awe of what I was watching. It was just super beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And it's also on Netflix, so people should go watch it. I was inspired to watch it. A friend of mine in our group chat was like, hey, did anyone ever seen Kubo? Like, it's really good. And I realized I hadn't seen it yet, so I watched it that night. Like,
nice.
Turns out, Dan, you were right. It's great.
I mean, I've also been telling you it's been good for like 2 years, but...
Yeah, but I don't listen to you.
Anyway, it was nominated for Best Animated Feature that year. It lost to Zootopia. Zootopia won that year. Okay. Which, you know, Zootopia's fine, but it's no Kubo.
It's no Kubo.
It's no Kubo. It's not even a... Like, Moana was also nominated. I would have picked Moana over Zootopia, but... Anyway, so that is Kubo and the Two Strings. I actually have it on Blu-ray, and I have not watched the Blu-ray yet, but I'm sure it looks awesome. Anyway, I've got a few things I want to talk about. The first is a TV show, and I'm curious if you guys have heard of the show. It's called Who is America?
I have heard about it, yes.
Okay, Kyle, you've heard of it. Mike, are you familiar with this?
I feel like I've heard of it, but I might be saying that because you just said it.
Okay, fair enough. So this is this is a new series that's airing on Showtime, and it was kind of a surprise release, but it's a new show from Sacha Baron Cohen, doing kind of his old bit that he kind of used to do on the Ali G show and Borat and stuff, where he's creating these new characters and going out and pranking people. But the targets of Who is America are generally political figures or people in power and that kind of thing. And this show is amazing. It's amazing. Like, if you've ever been a fan of Sacha Baron Cohen, you've seen, like, some bits, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure you've seen Borat and stuff like that. So you're familiar with the kind of things he does. And this show, like, you know, it seems... By 2018, I feel like I shouldn't be shocked by anything I see anymore in terms of what politicians will do or in terms of, like, what, like, how casually racist people will reveal themselves to be and that kind of thing. Like, I shouldn't be shocked by that anymore. And this show finds new ways to shock me while also... being very funny. I'll spend half the episode laughing very hard and the other half just in, like, my mouth agape in complete shock. But there are a few segments that have been floating around online and stuff like that, which you should definitely check out. There's one called Kinder Guardians, where Sacha Baron Cohen dresses up as this guy who talked to some Republican representatives, talks to Joe Walsh and a couple people like that, and gets them to endorse a gun program that would put guns in the hands of, like, four-year-olds to save their schools and that kind of thing. And they go along with it. They're just reading off the prompter and they endorse the idea. It's horrifying. But then on top of that, there was one just this past week on three episodes of aired so far. In episode three, he sits down with Roy Moore.
I saw this just yesterday.
Oh, yeah, no.
During Roy Moore's campaign. During Roy Moore's campaign, he talks to Roy Moore, and he's doing the same character he's doing in the Kinder Guardians episode. Like, he gets them there in the pretense of, like, he wants to talk about the campaign and stuff like that. But he's playing, like, an Israeli soldier, and he's talking about how in the Israeli army they've developed this device that actually can track pedophiles. And he's like, so you see, like, I put it on me, and obviously, like, I'll put it on you. And it starts beeping every time it goes to Roy Moore. And Roy Moore, like, gets so uncomfortable, and he storms out of the interview. It's so funny and fucking crazy.
So in Israel, they've developed a machine that is used in schools and playgrounds to detect anyone coming in. And if they detect the pedophile, the one that alerts the law enforcement and schools within a 100-mile radius. It is very, very simple to use. You just switch it on, and because neither of us are sex offenders, then it makes absolutely nothing. You just put it on, you put it nearby. Wait, this is obviously a problem. Hold on. It must be faulty. Sorry, is this your jacket?
Yes.
Did you lend the jacket to somebody else, maybe?
No. I've been married for 33.
Sure.
I never had an accusation of such things.
I am not accusing you at all.
Then, if this is an instrument, I'm not a pedophile, okay?
No, but the machine is...
Maybe Israeli technology hasn't developed properly.
This is 99.8% accurate. Well, it is not saying that you are a pedophile, of course not.
I am simply cutting this conversation right now.
No. Thank you. Have you been...
Been nice. I support Israel. I don't support this kind of stuff. Thank you.
No, I'm not saying that you're a sex offender at all.
But that's not even the craziest thing I've seen on the show. Like, it's like he's really going for it on a lot of these things. And certain politicians have come out, like, against the show. Apparently Sarah Palin shows up on the show at some point. And she, like, released a statement, like, weeks ago, like saying she was very offended and, like, all that stuff. And, like, you know, being pissed off at Sacha Baron Cohen and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That hasn't aired yet. Very excited to see it. But more recently, in episode two, there was this guy, Justin Spencer, who actually had to resign because of his actions on Who Is America.
I've seen this in a bunch of different news articles.
This
was bad.
It's amazing. This Cohen playing the same character he played in his other two segments. This has easily been his most successful character. He's talking to this Republican kind of city congressman. Like, it wasn't, like, a huge deal. I think he was actually on his way out already, but they made him resign anyway. But he's trying, like, this guy's, like, a firm anti-immigration type thing, and he does not hesitate for a second to be as racist as possible. Sacha Baron Cohen gets him to just scream the N-word, like, immediately, just screaming at the top of his lungs. At one point, Sacha Baron Cohen gets the guy to pull down his pants and, like, kind
what?
Of... you really got to see the segment. It's really remarkable how insane it is. And there's more to come. Like, I think it's, like, a 7-episode season, so there's still, like, 4 more episodes of this, and I can't even, like, comprehend what else is in store for this show. It's wild. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend Who Is America, especially if you've been a fan of Sacha Baron Cohen in the past. It's well worth checking out. And then I have a few movies I want to talk about besides that. Move past all that. The first is Sorry to Bother You.
Hey, young blood.
Let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on. You know what I mean. You have a white voice in there. You can use it. It's like being pulled over by the police.
Oh, no. I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the fuck up off the car and don't nobody get out.
All right, man. I'm just trying to give you some game. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Have you guys seen anything about this movie?
Yes, I haven't
only
seen it yet.
Only what I've heard you talk about.
Okay, yeah. So this is the new movie directed by Boots Riley, who's a rapper. And it feels like this is like every idea Boots Riley has ever had is just thrown directly at the screen. And it often works. It does not really feel structured, and I think would really benefit from some tighter editing. But everyone here is on the top of their game. Lakeith Stanfield is the star of this, and I've been a big fan of him for a long time. I mean, he's on Atlanta with Donald Glover, and he was in Straight Outta Compton, and he was in Get Out. He was in Death Note, and he was like the one good thing about the movie Death Note. but yeah, he's the star of this movie, and he's great. Tessa Thompson's also in this. Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead. Danny Glover. And the plot of this movie is that Lakeith Stanfield plays a telemarketer who puts on a white guy voice to try to get better sales, and it works. And he starts to climb the ladder, and it starts to become this really insane indictment on capitalism. And it's really fascinating. It gets weird as shit. Armie Hammer's in this too, also. He plays kind of the boss. And it has a third act plot twist that is horrifying and hilarious. Like, I could not believe what I was watching when I saw where this movie was going. If I told you what happened, I don't think you would believe me. So I recommend checking out Sorry to Bother You. I don't think it's as great as I hoped it would be, but it is still, there's so much good stuff here, and it's worth checking out. But that said, there's another movie that came out recently that kind of covers a lot of the same themes of Sorry to Bother You, which I actually liked a lot more, and that's called Blindspotting.
Oh, what is this? Oh. Oh. You got a little yes to rub?
Hey, I would like to get out.
Oh.
I got 3 days left on this probation, Miles, so let me
come on
out.
You got to let me hold one of these. Yeah, that
you can continue.
Give something for 200.
Your gun deal.
Yeah. One in that little visor thing right there.
The visor? Yeah. Of course there's one in the visor.
My goodness. Look. Precious me.
The one in my
Look
pocket.
At this.
Very nice. Why are there 6 guns in your car, Dad?
Oh, Colin, man, I like yours.
Right here,
that
this is not mine. Also, stop pointing at me.
They're not loaded, bro.
Those are for sure loaded.
Okay.
See?
Which is the new movie directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, also his directorial debut. And this is a semi-autobiographical movie about David Diggs and Rafael Cassell. They play two childhood best friends living in Oakland, and they wrote the movie together over a period of 9 years. David Diggs is the guy who played Jefferson in the original cast of Hamilton, and this movie is, I think, a lot. It covers a lot of the same themes as Sorry to Bother You. It covers gentrification and police brutality and racial inequality and class structures and all that. But I think it's a much more well-directed, well-edited movie. It's really funny, and it's only like an hour and a half, so it's very tight. And it's also very intense what it needs to be. The vibe is very much in the vein of, like, do the right thing. While Sorry to Bother You, I think, is covering similar territory to, like, Brazil.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's I think they would actually make for a really cool double feature if you get the chance. But yeah, and David Diggs is so great in this movie. So Blindspotting, really worth checking out. I think it's one of my favorites of the year. Sorry to Bother You, also really, really great. And then finally, I wanted to bring up one last movie that I saw. And this is really silly. I did not mean to go see this movie. It kind of just happened. but I did go see Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
My soulmate may actually be carbs. Then mine must be wine.
All three of us are grandfathers, and that's that.
Look what you've done with the place.
She wanted to make her mum proud.
If she hasn't done that all her life.
We can't tell anybody about the baby yet.
I just told Bill.
Yeah, and I told Harry. I told many, many people.
You're about to become a great-grandmother.
Great-grandmother. I'm leaving that out of the bio.
How do you not mean to go see that?
Well, I walked into the wrong theater. This isn't Mission Impossible. I guess I'll just sit down.
I mean, it's kind of the Mission Impossible of musicals, if you think about it.
Whoa.
I've heard it's the Godfather 2 of musicals.
Actually, yes. Courtesy of Vin, actually, friend of the show, who posted a very persuasive Facebook argument. Where he argued that Mamma Mia 2 is the Godfather 2 of musicals. He's not wrong. But anyway, yeah, Mamma Mia, here we go again. It's out in theaters right now. I have not seen the original Mamma Mia, because I remember when it came out, though, because it came out on the same day as The Dark Knight. And I saw The Dark Knight like 5 times in theaters. So I had no time for Mamma Mia. But anyway, first off, I want to just throw out there that Mamma Mia, here we go again, is the best title for any movie this year. It's a perfect title. For Mamma Mia sequel. Anyway, this one is really silly. It's a Mamma Mia movie. It's got ABBA songs. You know, it's basically, from what I understand, it's basically a remake of the first one. But it does star Lily James from Baby Driver, who I fell in love with in that movie. So I got to watch her smile for a long time, and that was nice. And she stars as a young version of Meryl Streep's character from the first movie. Meryl Streep barely in this movie. Lily James kind of plays the young character, and it kind of cuts back and forth between present day, where Amanda Seyfried is running the hotel, and the past, where Lily James is.
It really is Godfather 2. Oh my god.
Yep, that is one of Finn's arguments. But anyway, it's you know, for what it is, it's kind of enjoyable. Like it's pure fluff, but it's enjoyable fluff. Cher is in this movie. And she sings Fernando, so I was kind of happy about that. Actually, the reveal about when she sings Fernando is hilarious. It's really great. Also,
well, don't spoil it.
What?
Don't spoil it.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it. I just said it was a very funny reveal when it happens.
All right.
Because I was wondering throughout the whole movie, like, wait, when are they going to sing Fernando? Because there's no character named Fernando. And then suddenly the reveal happens, and it's like, oh.
Here we go.
Here we go. Yeah, and also, you know, they sing Dancing Queen, and that's a fun segment. They sing Mamma Mia, and, you know, it's fun. I feel like a lot of, like, I have not seen the first movie, but it seems like they're singing a lot of the same songs in this one. But, yeah, so that's Mamma Mia 2. I saw it. It was there. Here we go again and such. And now, let's move on into our featured review of Mission Impossible Fallout.
Your mission. Should you choose to accept it? I wonder, did you ever choose not to? The end you always feared is coming. And the blood will be on your hands. The fallout of all your good intentions.
You had a terrible choice to make in Berlin. One life over millions. And now the world is at risk.
This is the CIA's mission. If he had held on to the plutonium, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
His team would be dead.
Yes, they would. That's the job. You don't understand what you're involved in.
You need to walk away.
Please don't make me go through you.
How many times has Hunt's government betrayed him, disavowed him, cast him aside? How long before a man like that has had enough?
All right, that was from the trailer for Mission Impossible Fallout, the new movie written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie. It stars Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Sean Harris, Angela Bassett, Vanessa Kirby, Michelle Monaghan, Alec Baldwin, and also Wes Bentley is in this movie. That was a surprise, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Mission Impossible Fallout reads, Ethan Hunt and his IMF team, along with some familiar allies, race against time after a mission gone wrong. So, yeah. Mike, you rewatched the entire series before Fallout. I also rewatched the entire series before Fallout. Kyle, you did not.
I thought about it. I thought about all the Mission Impossible movies.
You thought about them real hard. You thought, yeah, for the amount of time the movie takes, too. So, like, each movie is 2 hours, and you spent 2 hours each on each movie just thinking
exactly
about the movie. So
I don't know how much all of my thoughts, I don't know how accurate they were. But this movie seemed to fall in line, and it made sense, so I was happy.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, for a refresher, where do you guys stand on the Mission Impossible series? What's your ranking of the movies? Kyle, you haven't seen the first three in a while, right? I think you were telling me that.
I saw three in theaters, and that's the last time I saw it. I saw two in chunks at a friend of mine's house when I was maybe 8.
Okay.
And I've seen bits and pieces of one on television and at parties. And
okay, yeah. so you're really a fan of the later series.
Yes.
The later movies,
yes,
in the series. Because I think we saw 5 together. We saw Rogue Nation together, actually.
Yeah.
And Ghost Protocol, I don't think we saw it together, but you definitely saw it in theaters, right?
Yes, I saw Ghost Protocol in theaters. I don't remember if I saw it with you, and those movies are just two of the best action movies out that you can see with your eyes. They're just beautiful. It's a spectacle, and it's nonstop, and those movies are fantastic.
Definitely. So, Mike, now you talked about the series a couple weeks ago on the podcast, so just real quick, do you want to give a refresher? Like, what's your take on each movie?
Yeah. The first one, I can't believe how much of a tight spy thriller it actually is compared to the rest of the series, which is, like Kyle just said, about beautiful spectacle action stuff, which is it's such a weird evolution of a franchise. It's also funny to compare it to Fast and the Furious movies, which in the second half of their franchise history became way better than they ever had been.
Yeah.
But my favorite is Rogue Nation, the last one. It's probably 5-4-1-3-2, so like almost descending order.
Okay.
And I don't know if I mentioned this last time when I was talking about it, but Kyle talking about like how you've seen the movies reminded me. I think Mission Impossible 2 was the first. I have so many weird like nostalgia movie things right from this podcast. I think that was the first DVD I ever rented from Blockbuster when we first got a DVD player.
Oh wow.
So I watched it like a million times. I remember watching it and like watching all the bonus features because that was new.
That's great.
Crazy weird nostalgia movie things.
That's awesome. Yeah. So my ranking, I mean, I think Ghost Protocol is my favorite. I really love Ghost Protocol. I mean, the Burj Khalifa sequence is a towering achievement in action movie history, but I would go 4-5 and then 1-3-2 probably, because yeah, it's I think overall, like, pretty much every movie I enjoy. I think 2 is easily the weakest, but it is still like a crazy insane John Woo movie, so it does have a lot of fun stuff going on, but it does feel very different than the rest of the movies that are going on. Like, they all feel like they kind of take place in the same universe, and the Mission Impossible 2 does not feel like that at all.
But you did point out to me last time we talked about it, it has the best line in the whole franchise.
That is true.
You said that to me, too.
Yes, Mission Impossible 2 does have the best line in the whole franchise because Anthony Hopkins is in that movie, which I had forgotten about. One of my favorite things about rewatching them was rediscovering actors who were in each movie that I had forgotten were in them.
Yeah.
So Anthony Hopkins is in number 2, and he has the best line where he says, well, so you think this mission will be difficult? And Tom Cruise is like, yeah, very. And he says,
well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
Perfect line. Delivered perfectly by Anthony Hopkins. But yeah, in each movie, you see, like Emilio Estevez is in the first one. And it's like, hey, Emilio Estevez, that's crazy. And then Anthony Hopkins and Thandie Newton are in the second one. And then the third one, it's like, Carrie Russell's here. And Lawrence Fishburne is here. And and Aaron Paul is here. Like, that's weird.
And Billy Crudup.
Oh, yeah, Billy Crudup. And then Mission Impossible 4, I was watching it. And I was like, I've seen Mission Impossible 4 a bunch. I remember everybody who's in this movie. And then Josh Holloway showed up. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And then also, who was it? I think Lea Seydoux. I remember that Lea Seydoux was in it, but she is in the movie. I feel like there's somebody else in the movie that I'm forgetting was in there. But
Paula Patton, maybe?
Well, no, I remember Paula Patton because she was a highlight of that movie for sure. But then in 5, I feel like there was somebody in 5 too. See, what happens is I'll watch them and then I'll to be like, oh, I forgot that actor's in the movie. And then I'll forget the actors in the movie again. But that is what's happening. Anyway. All that is to say, we're all big fans of Mission Impossible here, and we're all very much looking forward to Mission Impossible Fallout. So I will just say I'm trying very hard not to just make a sploosh sound and make that my review. I still think Ghost Protocol is probably my favorite, but Fallout goes to some absolute just insane extremes, and it almost looks like it's attempting to top itself with every scene, and I just admired so much about this movie. Kyle, I saw this movie with you, and I mean, the movie itself was great. Like, it was an incredible experience. Even better was watching you stress out while watching the movie.
It was a very stressful movie. It was very good. It was so much fun, and it was super intense. But as you said with a friend of yours who got to see the early screening, I felt like my thighs were just squeezing my balls. I was just so like, ugh! the whole time.
Yeah, you were making weird grunting noises, and you were going like, "Oh fuck!" You had like your hands like in your hair, like up your hair, and all that. Yep. Like it was a whole thing. It was quite a sight to behold. Yep. But yeah, so you were a fan. Let's say
I was a big fan. I was actually I didn't like the movie all that much. Didn't do it for me.
2 out of 5.
solid 2.
Yeah, Mike, what was your take on Mission Impossible Fallout?
I tweeted my official reaction was just, holy shit, what? Because that's basically what I said every scene. Because it feels like a 2.5 hour rolling action scene. Like, it just kind of is.
Yeah.
We start.
Nonstop.
Yeah, we start with a thing, and then we just keep going. And like, sometimes we stop to talk. But mostly we're punching for 2.5 hours. And, like, give me that shit.
All about that. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, most movies, I think, would be happy to have just one of the sequences in this movie as their big action set piece.
Right? For real.
And Fallout has, like, 10 of them. Just, like, peppered throughout. Like, it's nonstop. And I think what's cool about this, I mean, this is the first time a director has returned to the Mission Impossible franchise. Christopher McQuarrie directed Rogue Nation, and he came back to do Fallout. And he builds off Rogue Nation, I think, in a really interesting way. And I think in the process makes a movie that can also stand alone like the rest of the series. Like, you don't need to watch the previous 5 movies to enjoy Fallout. But I think it does help, because it does pay tribute to the rest of the franchise in small ways. And it does build off the relationships that were established in Rogue Nation with Ethan Hunt and Solomon Lane, and Ethan Hunt and Ilsa Faust as well.
Yeah, it's like one of those movies, it's... You don't need to see the other ones to appreciate it for what it is. And
right.
It definitely helps because you get the, like you said, the relationship with Solomon Lane and Ilsa. But that being said, it's not necessary to still be like, oh, fuck, what's going on? Holy shit, this is amazing.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I think as far as plot goes, and the movie is very thin compared to other Mission Impossible movies even, but at the same time, like, that's you don't really need it. It's unnecessary. This has become a franchise that is mostly about Tom Cruise hanging off of things. And it delivers on that in spades.
Oh, yeah.
Were you going to say something, Mike?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like while some of the plot might have been predictable, but there were still a lot of, like, twists and turns and stuff where I was like, wait, whoa, who?
Oh, yeah.
How do you, where did you, oh, and, like, yeah, there was still a lot of stuff that had me just, like, totally engrossed in what's happening to Ethan and his team in this movie.
Yes, definitely. But the movie series is about Tom Cruise being crazy, and I'm glad he's channeling that crazy into Mission Impossible movies, you know? Because I remember, like, in the mid-2000s, like, you know, Tom Cruise was, like, imploding on himself, right? He was doing the couch-jumping thing on Oprah and all that stuff. Like, it felt like, you know, people didn't like Tom Cruise for a very long time.
No.
Because of all that stuff, and the Scientology thing was weird and all that. But it seems like he's redeemed himself in the eyes of, like, the cinema-going public because he is just committed to doing the most insane shit of all time.
Yeah, and you know, I was sort of thinking back about that, and I was wondering, I don't remember the, you know, in my, I didn't do much research to, like, sort of pinpoint the turning point for him when he came back, and it seems like it might be, at least in my mind, was probably Edge of Tomorrow.
Which, you think so?
I mean, I don't remember what came out before that. That was, like, the big movie for him.
I think Ghost Protocol was the big comeback movie, like, at least in my perspective, because I remember that being like the Burj Khalifa sequence was huge,
yeah,
and people were talking about that a lot. I feel because Edge of Tomorrow, like, nobody saw that movie when it came out, you know?
No, like that's totally fair. But like, what? But did Edge of Tomorrow come out before or after?
That was 2014. Ghost Protocol was 2011.
What?
It was that long ago?
Yeah. Holy shit!
Ghost Protocol came out December 2011. Man,
what the hell?
Yeah. All it right. Was a
well,
while ago.
Never mind then. But I was going to make a Chris McQuarrie connection is where I was going with that.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fair, because Chris McQuarrie has been working with Tom Cruise for a very long time, actually, because he did, I think he did uncredited work writing Edge of Tomorrow, or maybe he's credited, but he also actually, I think, was consulted on Ghost Protocol, and he was consulted there. Brad Bird directed that movie, but Chris McQuarrie did kind of help a little bit here and there. But Chris McQuarrie has been writing for Tom Cruise since 2008. He wrote Valkyrie, which starred Tom Cruise, and, you know, he did Edge Tomorrow, like, he did Jack Reacher. He directed and wrote that movie, which is awesome, by the way. Have you guys seen Jack Reacher? Oh, yeah. Yeah, Kyle has not, but we reviewed Jack Reacher 2, so you definitely saw Jack Reacher 1.
Yeah.
And Jack Reacher 1 is awesome. Jack Reacher 2, not so much. But Jack Reacher 1, Great movie.
Yep.
But yeah, so he's got like a pretty great working relationship with Tom Cruise, and you know, that I think that really culminates in Fallout, where you see like the trust between actor and director and some of the crazy shit they get into in this movie, because you see some of the stuff that happens in this movie and you're like, okay, there must be some way they like CGI'd this or something. There's no way they could do this in real life. And then you see some behind the scenes photos and it's like, oh no, wait, nope.
We did that for real.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And I will talk about like the specific set pieces and spoilers. I feel like it's a spoiler to really even get into what happens in like in the set pieces.
Yeah.
You know, because that is basically the entire movie. But let's talk about some of the other actors. I think this movie does lose a little bit of the team dynamic that has been a highlight of the movies over the past few entries. And so, you know, I think it gets back into that towards like the second half. But the first half, it's mostly Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill, I feel like. Yeah. And Henry Cavill is great in this movie. Like, I think he is fantastic, and I can't really talk about much about his character without going into spoilers, but I will say it was very much worth his CGI face in Justice League to get him in this movie.
I was going to say, his mustache was worth every cent.
But outside of that, I mean, I think, you know, the first half of the movie, like, I feel like it's very light on... Rebecca Ferguson makes a couple appearances, but it's very light on Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg, and I would like to see more of them. You know, I like that team dynamic... that is going on, and about halfway through they start getting involved in more of the action scenes, and that it's cool. But and also I kind of miss Jeremy Renner, I gotta say.
Yeah, me too.
I'll agree. I was hoping that he'd pop up somewhere just doing some cool shit, but
yeah, I guess he was busy not being in Avengers
with his two broken arms.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably what it is. He broke both his arms on tag. But I mean, all the additions to this movie are really good. I mean, Alec Baldwin was back from Rogue Nation as well, and he's a lot of fun. But Henry Cavill's great. Angela Bassett's great. Vanessa Kirby is, I think, excellent as the arms dealer that Hunt is dealing with. The White Widow, she's called in the movie. She's great. I will say, I think the movie is about 2.5 hours long. I think it occasionally feels that long.
But I also
don't know what you would cut. I wouldn't want to lose a second of any of these action sequences. Like, they're so good. But all the other sequences that aren't action, I feel like build suspense so masterfully. That I wouldn't want to like cut those either. So it's 2.5 hours, but it's worth being 2.5 hours, if that makes sense. Yeah. But yeah, and I think one thing I do also really like about this movie, Chris McQuarrie's work, I think, kind of retroactively gives Ethan Hunt a character arc. Because I will say, I think for all of these movies, I think if you just watch one movie, like, Ethan Hunt is a cipher. Like, he's just there to like watch Tom Cruise explode in things. And Tom Cruise is very charming in the role, and he's very charismatic, so that helps. But Ethan Hunt as a character is very thin. Like, he's a very thin character. But I feel like with this movie, it looked at through the perspective of the entire series, it's kind of remarkable, like, how that character has changed. Because it's like the loss of his team in the beginning of the first movie is the inciting incident that, like, fuels his need to save his team at the expense of everyone else in this movie. And I think that's very cool. And it also, like, closes the relationship between Ethan and Julia from Mission Impossible 3 and all that. Like, it kind of builds on some of the stuff from the other movies, which is definitely very cool.
Yeah, I agree. It is funny to think about, you know, especially compared to the first movie, which has none of the stuff that is in the last three or four.
Yeah.
Yeah, to look back on that and compare that Ethan to this one, I think it is pretty impressive to make a sixth movie that explains the last five movies of character development, or
right,
provides the last five movies of character development.
Exactly. And what did you guys think of Sean Harris in this movie as Solomon Lane?
Oh, he was great. He was the perfect, like, creepy bad guy, and I thought he played the part perfectly. It made my skin crawl every time he was on the screen.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Philip Seymour Hoffman's still my favorite villain, just because he's so unlikely in the third one. But Sean Harris as Solomon Lane, I love what a counter to Ethan Hunt he is.
Right.
Who, you know, Hunt is all about this crazy chaos, and Lane is the most precise, calm, cool, and collected, terrifying, creepy villain. So I love Solomon Lane as a villain.
Cool. Yeah, I like him a lot more in this movie than I did in Rogue Nation. I like him a lot in this movie. And I liked him in Rogue Nation, too. But I think in Rogue Nation, like, I feel like he is only slightly better than the villain from Ghost Protocol. And the villain from Ghost Protocol is basically no one. Like,
I was about to ask, wait, who is?
Exactly. Like, Michael Nyquist plays the villain of Ghost Protocol. And Michael Nyquist is a good actor. I mean, he was the guy in John Wick. He was the father of the guy who kills John Wick's dog. But, you know, in Ghost Protocol, he just feels like he barely registers as a villain. As far as I'm concerned, Ghost Protocol is Tom Cruise fighting running. Like, that's basically fighting the concept of running. In Rogue Nation, you know, I think Sean Harris is a pretty good villain in that movie, but I think he's only, like, slightly better than Michael Nicfa's character in Ghost Protocol. I think in this movie, you get a lot more Solomon Lane, and you get, I think, more with his character that feels more interesting. So I like that about him for sure. I feel like he's kind of grown into a character who could be like the Blofeld of this series if they keep going with Mission Impossible movies. Do you think there will be more Mission Impossible movies after this? I feel like there almost has to be.
Yeah.
Only because this movie made $60 million in its opening weekend or whatever. It was the highest opening for a Mission Impossible movie ever. And I feel like they will continue this as long as Tom Cruise wants to keep, you know, injuring himself and
yeah,
you
know,
they'll continue it as long as he doesn't die on set.
Exactly. I mean, but the thing is, like, I don't know where you can go with Mission Impossible 7 from here. Like, it has to go bigger, right?
Space.
Space. It would be.
It's going to be Moonraker.
It's going to cross over with Fast and Furious in space.
Yes, but no. I think the difference is this movie would actually be shot in space.
Oh no, it 100% would be.
My dream Mission Impossible 7 is Tom Cruise hanging off the side of a rocket ship as it's being launched into space.
Oh God!
And he would do it for real.
Yeah. Oh no, 100%. Oh God!
Oh my God!
But anyway, yeah. So that's. I think we really got to talk about some of the specifics in this movie. So let's get into spoilers for Mission Impossible Fallout, starting right now. All right, spoilers from Mission Impossible Fallout starting right now. So I want to really dive deep into every one of these action scenes. First off, that Halo jump, though.
Oh, my God.
So this is Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill jumping out of a plane at, like, 25,000 feet. And they actually did this. They were jumping out of a plane and acting out a scene while they did it. They didn't actually do it during a lightning storm. That was added in with CGI, obviously.
Okay. Honestly, I wouldn't have been surprised.
Give me the money back.
But it's not only Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill jumping out of a plane. It's also the cameraman with an IMAX camera strapped to his chest.
Oh, my God.
jumping out with them. And they did this, like, 70 or 80 times. Like, something insane along the way. And they took the best three times, and they kind of spliced them together to make it look like it's all one take. It's a remarkable sequence. It's so cool. And I mean, there is, you know, the CGI storm going on, but it looks real. Like, it looks like a real storm. At one point, either Henry Cavill gets struck by lightning and it's like, holy shit, like, he's dead already. and then Tom Cruise has to save Henry Cavill, and he's doing it. Like, he's like Tom Cruise is flying through the air in real life to save Henry Cavill with one parachute. It's nuts. It's nuts.
So Tom Cruise is Henry Cavill's Superman in this movie.
Whoa.
It really is. And that's just like, that happens in the first like half hour of the movie. That could be the end of a movie.
Yeah.
That could be the big ending set piece of a movie, and it happens really early on. And then from there, I mean, there's the bathroom fight, which was incredible. There was no score to this fight, and I thought of you, Mike, when that happened, because I know you're a big fan of when it's no score and it's just punches.
And, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, there's no score, but you have the Henry Cavill arms reloading and stuff like that. and, you know, people are smashing through mirrors and stuff. It's pretty wild. It's a pretty incredible fight scene. And then from there, there's the Paris chase, where Tom Cruise is driving a motorcycle against traffic. And you think, well, they must have CGI'd some of those cars, right? Nope.
No, of course not.
No, that's Tom Cruise. And I'm sure the cars were slowed down in real life. Like, you know, they're doing these stunts as safely as they can, but they're still like, they're really doing this shit. And it's pretty wild. And so, yeah, Tom Cruise riding a motorcycle against traffic in the middle of a roundabout with like all these cars surrounding him. Like, it's crazy. And there's the underground shootout where Henry Cavill is revealed to be the villain, which we'll talk about that in a minute, but I love that reveal. I mean, it's a reveal I saw coming, but I love the way it happened. But the underground shootout is a lot of fun. It's really cool. And then there's the rooftop chase, which there has never been a more magnificent sequence of Tom Cruise running ever put to film. And there has been a lot of sequences of Tom Cruise running
Very many.
How many movies has Tom Cruise been in?
A lot. And I mean, even just in the Mission Impossible movies, it's a lot of running.
The only one he doesn't run in is probably Born on the 4th of July. Because his character's in a wheelchair.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mike.
For everyone who didn't get it.
I'm pretty sure Kyle didn't get it, so you're
that's why
nope,
I explained
that joke
it.
Went way over my head. Thank you for explaining it.
That was really good, though. Thank you. Although, I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it. Doesn't he start off not in a wheelchair?
I think there's a Vietnam sequence, yeah.
He might be running in that sequence.
Colin, check the minutes, Colin.
Check the minutes of Born on the 4th of July, Colin, please. But yeah, that whole running sequence is incredible. And that's the sequence where Tom Cruise actually broke his leg while filming. And they had to stop filming for a few months while he was healing his broken ankle. And then when he came back to filming, his ankle was still healing. But he was like, fuck it. I can keep doing this anyway.
I'll jump on the plane. It's fine.
Yeah, and so this is the one that feels like the most like a classic Mission Impossible sequence to me. Because in those first few sequences, they are awesome, but they don't really have a lot of the team doing their team like things. And this one, I mean, has Benji shouting back at him through the monitor and stuff like that. It has Tom Cruise running, so it feels like a much more classic Mission Impossible sequence. And then, of course, that all leads into the helicopter chase, which is the big climax of the movie. And listen. We have seen foot chases. We have seen car chases. We have seen motorcycle chases. We have seen boat chases. It's very rare that we get a helicopter chase, guys. And I mean, in the first Mission Impossible movie, there's a helicopter sort of chase. A helicopter and a train, and it's wild.
Yeah.
But anyway, so in this sequence, Tom Cruise actually learned how to fly a helicopter.
Jesus Christ.
Actually flying the helicopter around while trying to attack another helicopter, which he actually like was really doing. And then also really like flying in between all those mountains and stuff, which I am no helicopter expert. But
you're not?
I thought you were. I know. My pilot's license is in the mail. But but I was reading some stuff online and somebody was saying like, yeah, I was with my dad who flies that kind of helicopter, and he was blown away because that is the most dangerous shit you could be doing in a helicopter is flying it in the middle of those mountains and stuff like that. Like it's like, pretty nuts.
What insurance company is like, you know what? Fucking go for it. Just do it.
Just kill Tom Cruise. It's fine.
Yeah. This is the let's just do it and be legends of movies.
yeah.
It's pretty wild. And that has a whole like cross-cutting thing where, you know, Ilsa Faust and Simon Pegg are fighting Solomon Lane and Ving Rhames is trying to defuse the bomb. And there's all this stuff going on at the same time. It's an incredible sequence. And it's like, it's amazing how this movie just continually tops itself with every action sequence. Because usually with these Mission Impossible movies, the standout sequence is early on in the movie. You know, with Rogue Nation, like the big sequence is the opera sequence or the sequence where Tom Cruise hangs off the side of the plane or the underwater sequence. There's a lot of great stuff in Rogue Nation. But compared to the end of the movie, like it's just kind of this chase at the catacombs and Solomon Lane is trapped in a box. So, you know, it doesn't go crazy. It doesn't go all out in that movie. Or with Ghost Protocol, the Burj Khalifa happens halfway through the movie, you know, and that kind of thing. Really, I feel like a Mission Impossible movie hasn't ended on this insane of an action sequence since Mission Impossible 1 and 2. Because Mission Impossible 1 ends with the helicopter and the train, and it's wild. And if that was shot in real, like, today, Tom Cruise would insist on being on top of that train.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Near the exploding helicopter. And Mission Impossible 2 with the, you know, the crazy motorcycle chase and the exploding bikes and the kind of leap of faith into the air, and it's wild. So it's been a while since a Mission Impossible movie has ended on a sequence that is absolutely bonkers like this one.
Yeah, that helicopter chase, express them about this scene? Like, it's absolutely out of control, and that was the one thing where I was like, this is the one thing he can't have done for real, and yeah. I guess I was wrong.
He did it.
The absolute madman.
Yeah, and what I love about this chase, and this was pointed out to me in an article on Screen Crush, actually, the helicopter chase incorporates elements from every single Mission Impossible movie. Like, they all come together in that sequence. So the first movie has a helicopter hooking onto something it shouldn't be hooking onto and getting destroyed because of that,
yep.
Which happens in this one. The second movie involves Ethan Hunt rock climbing at the beginning. And that is a factor into this big final climax. And then you've got the incorporation of Julia from Mission Impossible 3. You've got the race against the clock, like Mission Impossible 4 has during its climax. And you've got Solomon Lane in the mix from Mission Impossible 5. So it, all these things from all these different movies are coming together in this one sequence. It's pretty awesome.
Wow.
Very organically, too. None of it felt like ham-fisted.
Right, yeah. It doesn't feel like it's consciously calling back, like, hey, remember when we did this? We're doing it again. Like, it's...
yeah.
You know? It's doing it in a different way and kind of remixing the series into something new. Which I really dug. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I definitely liked the rock calling thing only because I had just watched
Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, so I was like, oh yeah, that's like the, I get it. I see what you're doing. Yeah. For that one, I noticed
he knows how to rock climb.
Oh, yeah,
I remember.
I seen him do it.
Yeah, I'm disappointed he didn't throw his sunglasses into the camera like he does in Mission Impossible 2.
Man, if only.
But,
you know.
But yeah, so other stuff. I mean. The story beats in this movie. I think when this movie does take time to breathe, I think it does it really effectively, and it's still building suspense in a lot of those scenes. When the movie first starts, and you have that sequence in the alley where Tom Cruise pretends to shoot Ving Rhames, but actually he's alive and stuff like that, and the plutonium gets stolen, and then it cuts to the hospital, right? And it makes you think it's like 3 weeks later, and the plutonium bombs went off, and like Ethan Hunt's in like the darkest period of his life. I really thought that was the case. Like,
oh, yeah.
And the movie does a really great job of like setting itself up, like, wow, these are the biggest stakes Ethan Hunt has ever faced. Like, thousands of people are dead. Wolf Blitzer's reporting it on CNN, and that was key because here's the thing: I usually hate when I see like real life newscasters in movies. It kind of takes me out of it a little bit, but because they had a real life newscaster doing it. Like, it sort of made it feel more real, you know, because, like, and it kind of helped sell that scene a little bit, where it's like, oh, a real newscaster is telling this real, like, this thing is actually happening in the universe of this movie. This is wild. And then when the wool gets pulled under your eyes and the mask comes off and it's Simon Pegg underneath, it's the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. Only to be topped, later in the movie when it happens again. Yeah. It's great.
You were telling me when we were getting out of the movie, like, you never see it coming. Even when you see it coming.
Yeah.
These Mission Impossible movies have incorporated the masks in every movie, and I know for a fact they have these masks, and I should see it coming. I should know, like, yeah, these people have access to masks. At some point, there's going to be a dramatic reveal where a character lifts off their face. I never see it coming in any of these movies.
No.
When someone pulls off a mask.
I love that hospital sequence is a callback to the cold open of Mission Impossible 1, which they do, where they're in the first one, they're like getting some information from a Russian spy or whatever, and like all four walls of the room fall down as soon as he goes unconscious. Right. And I loved that when that happened in this one. I was like, oh shit, like it's the thing again, we're doing it.
So cool.
And I also love that this movie just like straight up makes fun of the masks at one point, right? Where Angela Bassett says it's Halloween, it's grown men running around in rubber masks.
Yes.
And I was like, it literally is. That's the whole plot of the whole, like, every twist in this every one of series. These movies.
Yeah. I never see it coming.
Yeah. And neither does Henry Cavill.
I know. And that's what made that moment so great. And I want to talk about that a little bit because I'm curious how you guys that moment I think is awesome when Henry Cavill is just monologuing his evil plan.
Yeah.
thinking that he's talking to Solomon Lane, right? And then it turns out that Solomon Lane is not actually sitting in that chair. It's Simon Pegg. And it's like, whoa. And, you know, it's one of those things where you don't realize it until like a minute before it happens. But then as soon as it happens, you're like, wait, how does that happen? Because you see Simon Pegg put on the Solomon Lane mask and then get up out of the chair and walk out of the room, right? So, and then it kind of makes a switcheroo when you're not looking so that it's Solomon Lane. And there was actually somebody asked Christopher McQuarrie about this, and he was saying, yeah, we cut out all the explanation for that scene. Like, it was there, and it was dragging the scene down, so we cut it out.
Yeah.
I guess there was like a whole like sequence where they showed how Simon Pegg got back into the room and switched out with Solomon Lane. But they cut it out of the movie because it was dragging things down. Like, it took too much time to explain. And he was like, it doesn't matter. And people were like, yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Kyle.
I think my favorite part about that scene was while Henry Cavill's monologuing and he looks back and he sees the mask computer in the corner and he realizes that it's not Solomon Lane. It cuts back to Solomon Lane, and just for like 2 seconds, he just turns into Benji.
It's yeah, like, I did notice that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that was great. I just wanted to, I thought about that a little bit when I was watching the movie, but I forgot about it because it is such a like, I feel like the explanation doesn't matter that much, and that's kind of what it is. But somebody wrote an article about it, Sam Adams, I think, for Slate, and he quoted Misery while he was writing it, and he was like, there's just one thing about Mission Impossible Fallout that I don't get. He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle chair.
That's amazing. I love that they pump fake the mask a couple times earlier in the movie, right? They try to use it, but Henry Cavill breaks the thing on the guy's face in the bathroom. and I also love that mask sequence is the masking sequence sort of calls out what we talked about Mission Impossible 3, or we might have talked about that off the air. When Tom Cruise turns into Philip Seymour Hoffman in one take on camera.
Yes.
This sort of has that weird camera movement trick that you think you expect to cut and then it doesn't, and we come back and it's been replaced already.
Yes.
So I thought that was a neat little reference, or nod to that technique or whatever.
Very cool.
But I also love that, we don't need the explanation. What's is it Alfred Hitchcock quote thing or whatever, like the refrigerator test? Where a movie just has to – you have to believe a movie long enough until you're standing at the refrigerator later that night when you think, wait, that doesn't work. if you realize it that much later, the movie's done its job. And I didn't even think of that. I had no idea. I totally believed that was possible and it happened and I was in.
Right. I mean, their whole thing is, pulling off impossible missions. So you just assume, well, they did it. That's
difficult should be a walk in the park.
Yeah, exactly. So Henry Cavill is also the villain of this movie, in addition to Sean Harris, and he is great. He is so good, I think. And I think he's very clearly it's played as a reveal when he gives that big monologue to Solomon Lane. Like, when I wrote those words, and it's like, okay,
yeah.
But he's very clearly the bad guy. Like the second he starts reporting on Ethan Hunt to Angela Bassett, he's like, I think Ethan Hunt's a mole or something like that, or he's the bad guy, and Angela Bassett's like, oh, what do you think about that? But it's obviously Henry Cavill. It's not going to be Ethan Hunt, intellectually. And you're thinking, it has to be somebody we know. Oh, wait, there's only one character it can be.
Yeah. Yeah. He also gives her not the right phone, right?
Yeah, the phone they took off the body was all busted up. And broken. Gives her perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he hands her a new phone, yeah. So you're right, Mike. That scene gave it away.
Yeah, fair enough.
At least, he is the only one it could have been, but the whole time I was still who's the real bad guy? I don't understand. Cause in my brain, I was like, all right, Henry Cavill is just this FBI agent who wants to fucking further his career by, ruining Ethan Hunt. And in my head, I'm like, all right, so who's the real bad guy? So when the reveal came, that's one of my hands in my hair moment. I was like, oh my God. It just done super, super well. And even if Mike saw it coming, it did the trick for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. But yeah, I think he is so good at being the villain in this movie. Like, we've seen him play the hero a lot in other things. I mean, obviously, he plays Superman. And I mean, you could argue he plays a very villainous version of Superman. But... but he is playing Superman, and he was a really charming hero in Man from U.N.C.L.E. too, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But we haven't really seen him play an out and out villain before, except for I guess part of Justice League, right? When he turns bad guy for a second
for 10 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, but that's too distract. Like you're too distracted by his weird face in that movie. Mm-hmm. But I think he is the best Mission Impossible villain since Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like straight up, I think he's great in this movie. And also Alec Baldwin dies in the movie.
Yeah,
throw that up there.
Major bummer.
A little bit of a bummer. I feel like we haven't gotten enough of that character. Like, he hasn't been a part of the team really that much. Yeah, he's only been in 5 and 6, and he hasn't really been part of the team. Like in the fifth one, he was kind of antagonistic toward Ethan Hunt, mm-hmm. and in this one, he is the head of the IMF. But he's only really in the beginning scene and that underground, the pre-underground shootout scene. Mm-hmm. And I think he's great in the underground shootout scene. Like again, there's that whole they sell it really well. Because that's leading up into the reveal where Simon Pegg is wearing the Solomon Lane mask, and they sell it really well that Alec Baldwin's bringing them all in, and the IMF is down, and they take out Alec Baldwin, and they're like, oh no, we're doing this on our own, and that kind of thing. Much like they do, they sell it really well at the beginning. So it really helps that they sell it so well, and that Alec Baldwin sells it so well in particular, and that when they reveal itself, when they have that big reveal that it's Simon Pegg, Alec Baldwin's having a blast in that scene. Oh man, this is a lot of fun. I see why you guys like this. And that kind of thing. And then he dies, and that's kind of a bummer, because I think he's a fun presence in this movie, in these movies, but I just feel like it's his character wasn't there enough to really warrant a huge emotional reaction for me anyway. But it's a functional death, which I guess establishes like some of the stakes in the movie. But the stakes were already there. Plutonium's on the loose.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But it's.
I was disappointed that his character died, just because I love the like the three scenes he's in these last two movies. Like, are great. I love. Like, he's having so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to actually, I just should throw this out there. In Rogue Nation, I think Alec Baldwin has the second best line in the entire series. Which is his big speech towards the end, where he's talking to the head of British intelligence, and he calls Ethan Hunt the living manifestation of destiny.
Sir, I urge you not to leave this room.
Excuse me.
Please. Hunt is uniquely trained and highly motivated. A specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. There is no secret he cannot extract, no security he cannot breach, no person he cannot become. He has most likely anticipated this very conversation and is waiting to strike in whatever direction we move. Sir, Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny, and he has made you his mission.
Yes.
incredible monologue. Incredible monologue. It's delivered great.
So, yeah, I'm sad that we're just not going to have that anymore. And it was fun, like, when he's sort of fighting Henry Cavill for a second. It was like, hey, remember when you were Jack Ryan, like, in 1985 or whatever? Like, that was cool. So I like that sequence for a second.
Cool. Yeah, but so he does die, and it's kind of a bummer. I think, if there's going to be a Mission Impossible 7, I feel like they should bring back Jeremy Renner and make him the head of the IMF. And that would
Angela
be a
Bassett
choice.
For head of IMF.
Just keep bringing in people who are against the IMF and making them the head of the IMF.
Yes, and then they die at that next movie, and then it happens again, and then...
Yeah, it'll be like how in Fast and Furious movies, the bad guys always turn into good guys.
Yes.
They're going to just take...
they learn the true meaning of familia.
Exactly.
The impossible mission familia. Sorry.
The impossible mission familia. We should really cross these franchises over at this point.
They're getting so close, man.
They have gotten so big and so over the top.
I love how different, like, in the last Fast and Furious movie, they fought a submarine in Antarctica. Like,
right.
so farcical and so not part of Earth. And then in Mission Impossible, like, Tom Cruise is actually halo jumping. Like, I love how different the two franchises are.
Yeah, they've both gone completely over the top in completely different ways.
Yeah.
Which is pretty great. And the Fast and Furious movies, to their credit, like, they do a lot of real stunts in those movies involving cars and stuff. But obviously, they're not going to be, they're not actually driving a car in between three buildings 100 stories high, you know? It's, they're not actually doing that. But there is a lot of, like, real stunts going on in those movies, especially in Fast 5 and 6, I think. But yeah, no, the Mission Impossible movies have grown in such a way where they're, like, doing outlandish things, like things that you don't think would actually be possible, but they're doing them for real, so they are actually possible. The real Mission Impossible is doing these stunts. The stunts we did along the way. But yeah, also, Rebecca Ferguson back in this movie, she's great, kicks a lot of ass. She basically shows up just to save people's asses every time she shows up, and it's great. She has one of my favorite moments in the movie, actually, during that bathroom fight, which is after Henry Cavill destroys the mass technology by smashing the laptop over the guy's face, which was a fucking brutal smash, by the way. And so Ethan's trying to get it to work, and it's not working. And so Cavill's like, what are you going to do? And Hunt's like, I'm going to wing it. And and Cavill's like, winging it is not a plan. And Rebecca Ferguson, like, without looking back at him, is like, oh, you must be new.
Yeah.
It's a great line. She delivers it really well. But I think if Tom Cruise ever retires from these movies, like, Rebecca Ferguson is the clear person to take over. Like, hopefully she's willing to do the insane amount of stunts that Tom Cruise is capable of doing. But even if she's not, like, she's, like, easily, like... I remember when Ghost Protocol was coming out, and people were like, oh, Jeremy Renner is being positioned to take over the franchise. And then it actually came out, and people were like, no, I don't want that. but, like, if Tom Cruise, left the series or something, or retired, like, Rebecca Ferguson would be a perfect replacement. You know, she's like waiting in the wings, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed that this one gives into the romantic storyline need between Ilsa Faust and Ethan Hunt.
Okay.
That was one of my favorite things in Rogue Nation, is that, you know, the cliche is that these two people are going to, like, that's the romantic connection we're going to have, and it head fakes and it doesn't happen, and it's nice to see that in an action movie where the female lead does not become the romantic lead.
Sure.
And then in this one, they were like, yeah, but yeah, they do.
Well, they don't really, I mean, they don't explicitly say that, I feel like. I mean, they kind of do. I think Ving Rhames does say there are two women in Ethan's life that he's cared about, like, specifically. One of them's Julia. And he doesn't name the other one, but, like, it's implied that it's Rebecca Ferguson. Yeah. But I just threw in there, like, oh, what if he's talking about Thandie Newton? Is he talking about Thandie Newton from Mission Impossible 2?
Thandie Newton, right.
That's got to be who it is. But, yeah, so I get that, and that makes sense. But it also, like, it does sort of make sense for Ethan's character, like, if he's not going to be with Julia,
yeah,
right, because that's not going to work. He can't have a domestic life because he's Ethan Hunt. If he's going to be with anybody, I feel like Ilsa is the logical choice for him to be with. Like, yeah. if it's also going to be somebody who's also doing crazy shit and, like, doing all these missions and stuff, like, so it kind of makes sense. Like,
oh,
it makes sense. It makes sense the way they did it. I don't dislike it. But no, you're right. I agree that like Rogue Nation handles that a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like a personal nitpick. Like, it doesn't take away from the movie. I just would have been cool. I don't know. I don't know what they could have done instead, but it was just the thing I was slightly disappointed by.
Yeah, and speaking of Julia, I mean, what did you think of Michelle Monaghan's appearance in this movie?
That, for me, I was already tense about the end of the movie. And then when he just rounds the corner and she's there, that just took it up like another level. I'm like, fuck, why are you here? And that just added a whole nother level of tenseness for me. And like the whole time when she walks up and she sees Ving Rhames disarming a nuclear bomb and she's like, how can I help?
Right. I mean, I really like seeing her again, and I think it does an important part in doing some of that retroactive character work for Ethan Hunt, like I was saying before, right? It kind of closes up their relationship and stuff like that. Because the last time you really see her, I mean, you see her as a cameo at the end of Ghost Protocol, where they kind of see each other across the way. But really, the last time you see her in Mission Impossible 3, like, they're happily married. Like, they're just going off into the sunset. Yeah. And so you never really got, like, a specific... Like, Ghost Protocol kind of gives you some backstory about what happened with them, but you don't really get, like, a specific sense of really, like, what their relationship is like anymore. So I liked seeing her again, and having her be involved in the climax was pretty cool. Also, she's married to Wes Bentley now, which is wild.
How about that?
Yeah, I didn't see that. I was watching the movie, obviously, and the opening credits came up, and I saw Wes Bentley's name, and I was like, what? Because I haven't seen him, like, any of the commercials or anything, like, none of the trailers or anything like that. And, I mean, he plays such a small role in this movie, like, there's no reason why he would be. But, like, Wes Bentley's there, and he's such a nice guy in this movie. He's such, like, the good guy husband.
Yeah.
He's, like, totally cool with meeting her ex-fiance or ex-husband or whatever. Like, he's cool with it. So that was neat.
It's funny that he's always, like, typecast as, like, the, you know, like, hard-ass, like, by-the-book, like, middle management guy in so many of these movies. Like, the suit that has to give you the bad news because, like, whatever. And for this, he's just like, yeah, like, I'm a world-traveling doctor. I help the needy. It's cool. I eat a lot of granola, probably.
Also, wanted to draw a connection here. I don't know if you caught this, Mike. I don't know if you saw this online. But Vanessa Kirby's character, White Widow, she mentions her mother, whose name was Max. And Max was the name of the arms dealer played by Vanessa Redgrave in Mission Impossible 1.
I did not notice that. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's a pretty cool callback to the original movie as well. And, I mean, even, like, Vanessa Kirby and Vanessa Redgrave look very similar, I think. Like, it's definitely a conscious choice. And I think it is kind of a cool way. I mean, you look at Ethan's relationship with Max in the first movie and the White Widow in this movie. And in the first movie, Ethan Hunt is this, you know, young, hotshot agent who's, like, dealing with this very seasoned arms dealer in Max. And in this one kind of reverses that dynamic, right? Where she's, like, this one, the White Widow is kind of, like, just getting to the game, and Ethan Hunt has been around. He's been around the block several times, at several impossible missions. And so I like the way it kind of turns that on its head. And again, these movies, I think, with any long-running series like this, I feel like they almost inevitably become about the main character's aging.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that with the James Bond movies, and we've seen that with the James Bond movies, and I can't think of anything right now, but we've seen that with, like, a lot of the TV revivals recently too. Like, we've seen it with, like, Twin Peaks and stuff like that.
Right.
So I think these movies are starting to get into that a little bit, especially with, like, with Ghost Protocol and with Rogue Nation, especially. I remember when we talked about Rogue Nation when it came out, we were like, yeah, this is, like, the first time you ever see, like, Tom Cruise really, like, start to get, like, tired during scenes, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, you see him, like, breathing heavy and stuff. And this one continues that, too. I think Chris McQuarrie actually was saying that the one of, like somebody he was doing like a Twitter Q&A. And somebody tweeted at him, like, what's your favorite, like, small detail in the movie? And he's like, the breaths that are in there that should not be in an action movie during the bathroom brawl is what he was saying. Because, like, you can see how, like, Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill are getting exhausted while they're doing that fight. And it adds a lot to the realism of those sequences, I think.
Yeah. I love the, like, once the Lark that we think rips the pipe out of the sink and, like, that... Was yeah. the cool? That was some John Wick shit, and in the coolest way.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, other stuff. I mean, Ving Rhames gives a surprisingly emotional performance in this movie.
Yeah,
I thought he was great.
He's mostly just been like the guy who's like on like guy in the chair kind of thing in these in these movies. To quote Ned from Spider-Man: Homecoming. He's done a great job of being that, and you know he's been like pretty like other than Tom Cruise, he's the only one who's been in all the movies, I think. And so he is like a staple of this series, and so it's kind of cool to give him like a little bit more to do in these movies, even though for the most part he is mostly still just sitting down, like he's like he is not doing the stunts that Tom Cruise is doing in these movies.
I'd watch that movie though.
You watch a movie of Ving Rhames sitting down?
No, of Ving Rhames doing the stunts that Tom Cruise does.
Yes. Oh my god.
Can you imagine, like, Ving Rhames hanging off the side of a like a plane, like in Rogue Nation? Like, it would look hilarious.
Oh, man. Or just him climbing up the side of the Burj Khalifa.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yes. And actually, Ving Rhames has one of the funniest moments in the movie when Simon Pegg is, like, asking why he has to be Solomon Lane. And Ving Rhames, like, without saying a word, just kind of motions to Benji's body and then motions to his own body. It's like... But yeah, otherwise, any other stuff you want to get? You guys want to talk about? Any other things in the movie that stood out to you?
I do want to shout out. Also, no soundtrack in the Paris car chase scene.
Yes, yeah, there's no score in that either.
No score.
Yeah, and I know you are a big fan of that.
I love that shit.
I think you highlighted that in Rogue Nation too, because there's no score during the car chase in that movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, or the motorcycle station. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely a cool feature. But that said, the music in this movie also good because the Mission Impossible theme, and the Mission Impossible theme is one of the best themes of all time. It's so good. Absolutely. I get so pumped every time I hear that theme. Especially when I was doing my rewatch, when I was watching the first one, you know, they play at the beginning during the opening credits, right? And then, you know, the movie's going on, and about an hour passes, and then Ethan Hunt assembles Ving Rhames and John Reno. And, you know, he's explaining the entire plan to them about how they're going to break into the CIA. And Ving Rhames says, like, that's impossible. We're not going to do it. And Tom Cruise just kind of smiles and says, we're going to do it. And as he's saying that, you hear, and then you hear, bom, 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 bom. And I remember when I was watching it, like, I, like, screamed, yeah! Like, here we go! I was alone. I woke up my dog. It's fine. But yeah, it's just a fist-pumping theme.
Yeah.
And it's great. And, you know, it's had many variations over the years. We all remember Limp Bizkit's version from Mission Impossible 2. How can we forget?
Yeah.
Can't believe that was a real thing that happened. But yeah, I think the way it played, like Danny Elfman's version in the first movie is probably still my favorite version. I really do like Michael Giacchino's version in, I think, the fourth one or the third one. But anyway, it's a great theme and it kicks off a great series. Otherwise, any other last minute things, guys, or should we wrap this up?
One shot that I really, really liked towards the end was when it was getting down to the last couple seconds with the nuclear bombs and they're like, all right, we have to cut on one. And like, oh, do you really want to cut it that close? And they cut it, and it cuts to white.
Yes. Yeah, I thought, yeah.
And it's like, holy shit, did they fail? And then it cuts to Ethan Hunt on the side of the mountain, and you can only see the sun, and you can't really tell what he's looking at.
Is that a mushroom cloud? What is that?
Is that a mushroom cloud? What is that? And then it cuts to the front of him. He's just got the thing in his mouth, and he's holding the controller, and he did it.
1 second. Yeah, it's great. It's such great catharsis. We actually haven't even really talked about what happens after the big helicopter chase. Because, I mean, there's the helicopter chase and all that's going down, but then, like, you know, the helicopter crashes, and he and Henry Cavill are on the cliffside, and they're rock climbing, and the helicopter, like, the hook catches onto the side of the rocks, Tom Cruise just, like, pulls the rope, and it all comes crashing down on Henry Cavill, and it's fucking insane.
It just hooks him in the face after his face has been skid across the ground and half of it's gone.
Oof.
I wondered when that moment, right, when Henry Cavill stands up and he turns toward the camera, he's got, like, his hair is disheveled, and he's got a curl. And I wondered if that was a deliberate...
Oh, like man. Superman reference?
Superman curl? Yeah.
I hope it was.
I hope it might be.
I mean, he doesn't really have a curl in the ass when he's Superman, right? Like, I don't think he does.
No, I don't think so, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, he should, because he's Superman. Superman should have a curl.
I thought that curl was just a big middle finger to Warner Brothers. Like, edit this out, assholes.
Yeah, the mustache wasn't enough of a middle finger. They had to, yeah. had the curl. Anyway, yeah, so that is Mission Impossible Fallout. We are all big fans. I will probably try to see it again at some point soon, because I feel like I need to see it again at least one more time in theaters. It's so good. It's so good. Now I don't. I did want to mention this briefly. MoviePass is spiraling lately.
Oh yeah.
over the past few months, it's like, as a subscriber to MoviePass, I'm bummed that it's probably going to not exist soon. But also, it's been hilarious to watch.
it's been a nightmare.
But anyway, when I went to go see Mission Impossible Fallout, I was all, you know, set to check into my MoviePass, and it wouldn't let me. It would not let me check into Mission Impossible Fallout. It actually, like, grayed out. So all the other showtimes for other movies were available, and I could see Mission Impossible Fallout in the app, and it wouldn't let me click it. Because MoviePass was scared that too many people would see Mission Impossible using the MoviePass, and they would run out of money again, because that happened last weekend.
Yep.
where the app literally ran out of money, and it wouldn't work for anybody. And so they had to, like, borrow, like, $15 million or whatever to stay afloat. But they're not going to last much longer. Like, they are... Or if they do, they will be bought out somehow, or, you know, they won't exist in their current form. I think they're raising the prices now to $15 a month.
Yeah.
And I would be fine with that. But they're also going to be blocking out bigger movies like Mission Impossible, which is dude.
And even that, I bought this.
And it's their definition of what a bigger movie is, right? So the other day, you know, they recently added surge pricing to the MoviePass app, which means that for crowded showtimes, for popular showtimes, you will be added a surcharge to the thing, which isn't what I signed up for. But I was like, okay, well, the surcharge won't be that much, and it's only going to be for, like, really crowded movies. On Sunday, I went to go see Blindspotting, an indie movie. It was a 2 p.m. matinee on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
There was two other people in the theater. MoviePass tried to surcharge me $8.
What?
$8, Mike. And then I was like, well, you know what? $8, still cheaper than, you know, $11. So I guess I might as well do it. But then I tried to check in, and it wouldn't let me check in.
Oh, gotta love it.
So, yeah. So MoviePass, not great. Not great anymore. I mean, it was a great service while it lasted, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. Actually, I checked MoviePass yesterday just to see what was going on. And... it said there are no showtimes available at this theater at all. Like, it didn't show any movies. It said this theater is not showing movies. And I checked it for every theater in my area. It was doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, I think that happened across the whole app yesterday.
Yeah, no, they were saying, like, technological issues or something. And...
something along those lines. And I checked again today, and it was fine. Like, it was working again. But for how long, I don't know. So we'll see how it works. I mean, I'm moving to Missoula, Montana, and there are two AMC theaters right nearby, and AMC just revealed their own version of MoviePass, which is $20 a month, and it's not unlimited movies, it's like three movies a week, but that's probably exactly what I need.
Yeah.
I'll probably make the switch once I move out to Montana, because it's like, MoviePass, man, it's just not gonna
work. It was nice while it lasted.
It was so nice while it lasted. What were you saying, Mike?
Sorry. I'm so sad, though, because I just a personal anecdote. They've been renovating a theater that's the next town over. It's like 5 minutes away for years. And it was the theater I always went to. They renovated it. It just opened, and it's beautiful. And I saw Mission Impossible and RPX there yesterday, and it was awesome.
Nice.
And I was like, damn, like, if this had opened last year, I would have had MoviePass, and I would have seen a million movies. Because the next nearest theater that I would have gone to is, like, a half hour away, and that's too much effort to, like, come home from
right.
work and then go to a movie kind of thing, which is what I would have wanted MoviePass for. And now I can do that, and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's not gone yet. If you want to still sign up.
Yeah, let me get in now.
Well, I can only say that MoviePass very, very shortly will be disappearing like dust in the wind, like the hobo from the Polar Express.
Oh, my God. Did Vin tell you to say that?
No, I said it because I knew he would get a kick out of
Amazing.
It.
Amazing.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad you were able to work that in. All right. So, Kyle, you got anything you want to plug this week? Where can we find you online? Anything like that?
Well, I don't use my Twitter. I don't really post on Instagram. And, yeah.
Do you have music? Any SoundCloud? Anything?
I mean, you got music in the works, right?
I'm putting out music hopefully pretty soon. Nothing solid yet. And once I do put it out, I'll have you plug it, unless you want to have me back on the show to plug it.
We'll see what happens, Kyle. all right, fair enough. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, Instagram at Radio Mike Sandwich, Letterboxd at Mike Smith Film. I should really just make all those one thing. But
what is branding?
Exactly. What is it? MoviePass doesn't understand it.
Nope.
and you can find all our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thanks so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike's Crecio. And that's Kyle Cullen. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast, your email, about the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones. It's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us. Hopefully within 2 months. That's the goal right now. We'll be back in September after our brief hiatus, where our next review will likely be The Predator. And I am very excited about that movie. It's a new Shane Black movie. It's a new Predator movie. What can go wrong, guys?
Yeah, that feels like a good movie for us to come back on.
That's what I figured. And it comes out like September 14th, and I'll actually be at a wedding that day, but I'll come back and we'll see Predator and we'll talk Predator. It's going to be great. And you can check out our next Complete Works, whenever that is, where I'm so sorry, Mike, that this happened, but you actually watched the movie already.
For the first time in Complete Works history, I watched the movie earlier than the day before we recorded.
Yeah, and at the last minute, I was like, you know what, maybe we should skip this, because I got like things to do, because I'm moving, and you were like, God damn it. but anyway, we're talking 2011's Trespass, directed by Joel Schumacher, when we return from our hiatus, so sometime in September, probably, we'll get back on that. Anyway, so thanks, Kyle, for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, and thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.